The end of the impeachment process means the end of Impeachment, a daily podcast. But this doesn't have to be goodbye. We will continue podcasting daily under a new title. What I can say right now is that we'll continue to follow national politics and sometimes other things Monday through Friday in this very consequential and action-packed year. We do this daily on my live radio show, and we'll pick the best conversation from the show each day for the podcast. You'll see it in your feed in a few days, and then we hope you choose to stay with it. This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Thursday, February 6th. The impeachment trial of Donald Trump is over. The aftermath, though, is just beginning. John Bolton's book will come out next month. Also next month, the Supreme Court will hear the case on whether presidents can be criminally investigated, as Trump is still trying to hide from the Stormy Daniels hush money scheme that his lawyer Michael Cohen is in prison for and which prosecutors say Trump directed. The courts will also rule on whether White House counsel Don McGahn can be forced to testify publicly, even now, about Trump's multiple instances of obstructing justice, as McGahn testified to privately in the Mueller report. Trump can say, totally vindicated today, all he wants, but things won't be the same. Congress won't be the same either. New Jersey Congressman Jeff Van Drew left the Democratic Party over this. Michigan Congressman Justin Amash left the Republican Party. And Mitt Romney, Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, the last Republican presidential nominee before Donald Trump, became the first U.S. senator ever to vote for the removal from office of a president from his own party. I'll say that again. The only U.S. senator ever to vote for the removal from office of a president from his own party, despite the barrage of attacks he knew would come that have now begun. So let's start with the Mitt Romney story today. Agree or disagree with his conclusions, Romney's remarks before casting his vote will go down as one of the most memorable Senate floor speeches in American political history. Here's an excerpt as he invokes his Mormon faith. And listeners, you can't see this on the radio, but Romney has to stop for a few seconds because he starts to cry. You'll hear that silence in this clip.
I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong.
Later in his remarks, Romney says why he thinks Trump's behavior is worthy of removal.
Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine.
And here's one more Romney excerpt. This runs about a minute and a quarter. Romney addresses the impulse and the pressure to just stick with his party.
In the last several weeks, I've received numerous calls and texts. Many demanded in their words that I stand with the team. I can assure you that that thought has been very much on my mind. You see, I support a great deal of what the president has done. I voted with him 80% of the time. But my promise before God to apply impartial justice required that I put my personal feelings and political biases aside. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience. I'm aware that there are people in my party and in my state who will strenuously disapprove of my decision. And in some quarters, I will be vehemently denounced. I'm sure to hear abuse from the president and his supporters. Does anyone seriously believe that I would consent to these consequences other than from an inescapable conviction that my oath before God demanded it of me.
Mitt Romney, before casting the only vote in the history of the Senate to remove a president from a senator's own party. Democrats are calling it a profile in courage. But as you heard in that clip, Romney anticipated out loud the attacks that would inevitably come from his own party. And yes, to quote Donald Trump on Marie Yovanovitch, Mitt Romney is going to go through some things. It's already begun. Here's a bit of an attack ad that's already out from a pro-Trump group.
Posing as a Republican, he tried to infiltrate Trump's administration as Secretary of State.
President-elect Trump is the very man who can lead us to that better future.
Now his cover's blown, exposed by news reports as a Democrat's secret asset.
And here's Donald Trump Jr. last night on Fox attacking Romney as weak.
Because when he had his shot, he couldn't do it. And he's more concerned about attempting to be loved by those who hate his guts, by the media, by the left, who destroyed his political career, who destroyed his presidential run, than he is about doing what his constituency actually wants. And it's become now so transparent that you can't even hide from it. He's not brave. He's a coward.
He's a coward. So there we are for America to decide on about whose character they choose to identify with, Mitt Romney's or Donald Trump Jr.'s.
I swore an oath before God.
He's a coward.
They speak, you decide. With me now, Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the WNYC podcast Trump Inc., which follows the intersection between Trump's business interests and the public interest. She has an article in the New York Review of Books called Corruption with No Consequences, From Bridgegate to Impeachment, and her new book, American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power, is now on the New York Times bestseller list. I recuse myself from being objective about that. Yay.
Hi, thank Andrew. Thank you, Brian.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for coming on. Agree or disagree with impeachment, it's hard to think Romney did anything but what he said, followed his conscience to a controversial end. I can't see any political gain for him. Why do you think he went out on that limb?
I take him at his word. And it was really, was kind of extraordinary because, I mean, we covered the 2012 election when Mitt Romney was the nominee. And it really took me back to a different era where, agree or disagree, there was a shared sense of you should tell the truth and you should follow your conscience. Now, obviously, people didn't always do this, but they felt that they should. And I think what I really saw yesterday in watching Romney's speech was how vast the gulf is between that time and this time.
So the uniqueness of this vote is a reminder that partisan politics, though extreme right now, are nothing new. No Democrat voted to remove Bill Clinton. And then going back to Andrew Johnson in 1868, nobody from his party voted to remove him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. But I think what we have all been listening to and watching for the past months is extraordinary. The president invited a foreign power to interfere in an election, and even though he called it perfect, the facts are not in dispute. So, I mean, that is something that the framers very specifically addressed when they were writing the Constitution. They thought that this kind of thing was going to be as threatening as war to the republic. So I think that that may be true, what you say, but I also think that it was, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising to any of us, given how loyal the Republican Party and how lockstep they've been, really, since Obama was elected. But it was a moment.
And certainly, in fairness to history, Republicans did cross over in the Nixon case, so much so that it never got to an impeachment vote. You know, the term profiles in courage, which we've heard quoted a lot, stated a lot in the media over the last day about Mitt Romney, profiles in courage. It comes, for those of you who don't know this history, from the book of that title by John F. Kennedy before he ran for president. It was in the mid-50s, and it was about exactly this: United States senators who resisted pressure from their own party or constituents to do what they believed to be the right thing. There were eight of them, John Quincy Adams, and then, you know, on toward more modern times. And this is a textbook case. But Trump is trying to turn it on its head and say Romney voted to convict because he's a coward, not because he has courage, afraid of the left, even though there's no left in his state of Utah to speak of. It doesn't even make sense. But maybe in today's tribal climate, that doesn't even matter.
I think it doesn't matter. I mean, I think we're in a stage where we saw it in the State of the Union the other night. Trump feels empowered to say anything. I believe the Washington Post tracked 30 lies just in the State of the Union. And this is a president who feels emboldened to say anything and who uses his lying, when everybody knows that he's lying, as a way to express his power. So he can say it's not raining when everybody knows it's raining, and it's a way for him to express his dominance. And I think we got a preview during the State of the Union of what to expect, which is that he's going to just do more and more and more of that during the 2020 campaign.
And the president's line now is that he's totally exonerated, vindicated, acquitted for life was one phrase I heard, that the acquittal is a victory for the American people. He said, but we have not just Romney, but Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski saying his acts were shameful. She used that word. Senator Lamar Alexander saying the charges were proven. He used that word. Even if they thought removal was the wrong remedy and voted to acquit. And there were other members of Congress, too. So that is Republican senators. So the American people will decide between now and November if they think the emperor, who calls himself perfect, has clothes or doesn't have clothes. Do you think the accumulated Republican soundbites from this week, not just Romney's, will wind up playing a role in the fall campaign?
I mean, I imagine so. But I think, you know, I mean, it's very... First of all, it's really a long time to November. So many things can happen. I mean, think of what's happened this year. It seems like it's already been a year, and we're only like a month and a week into it. But I think that the question is how the larger population is going to feel about this acquittal with no witnesses and a sort of clear corruption of the process. There wasn't a reckoning. There wasn't a chance to hear from the people who knew about it because the president and the White House effectively obstructed.
But on the witnesses question, I think it cuts both ways. And this was one of the contradictions in the Democrats' case, to be honest. When they were urging the senators to vote for witnesses, they were saying we need witnesses to make our case. But at the same time, in the same closing arguments, they were saying we have proved our case. Case closed. We proved it beyond a shadow of a doubt. So they were arguing those contradictory things. And there were so many witnesses who did prove the case. Bill Taylor and Marie Yovanovitch and Gordon Sondland, and we don't have to go down the list. But I don't know if anybody cares about Ukraine, because we've heard from so many reporters on this show covering the Iowa and New Hampshire campaigning that people at the town halls that the candidates were holding just didn't bring up Ukraine.
I mean, I think that's true. I mean, okay, so there's a lot to unpack in that. I think that the question of witnesses, I mean, obviously the transcript was released from the White House. Witnesses testified. People that worked for the president said there was a drug deal. There was a quid pro quo, et cetera, et cetera. But there was the people who were closest and who would come in under oath and had to swear to tell the truth, who had direct interactions with the president. So Pompeo, Mulvaney, Bolton did not testify.
Right.
And I think the question is, over the course of the election, whether there's a cumulative dissatisfaction with the sense of this sort of increasingly authoritarian acting president, acting as if and explicitly stating the law doesn't apply to him. Impeachment doesn't apply. And also, the laws of the land don't apply.
And that will get into the content of your New York Review of Books article, which we'll do in a minute. But on the politics of the moment and the people's judgment to date, let's not kid ourselves. Maybe the impeachment case will hurt Trump in the long run. We'll see. But in the short run, this Gallup poll this week shows his approval rating at the high point of his presidency, 49%. And maybe as important, the Republican Party's approval rating jumped from about 40% to about 50%, when Democrats want to take back the Senate this year almost as much as they want to take back the White House. So put on your political analyst hat. I mean, the poll could be wrong, but assuming it's saying something real, tell us what you think happened.
I mean, you know, it's hard to know, but perhaps people believe that he was unfairly victimized and or other things in their lives are going well, which can also track a poll. So, I mean, so much has happened. There was almost a war with Iran this month. There is the coronavirus, which the U.S. is responding to. There are so many things that are happening to that happening that it's hard to know at any one moment if that's impeachment that is stimulating that. It could be. It could be that he has managed to portray himself as a victim, and more people than not are believing that. The only thing that I have to say about that is it is, I mean, so long to the election, and we'll without doubt be talking about something different on October 25th, 2020.
So your article is about whether Trump can still be held criminally responsible at some point for official corruption, that is, using official government acts for personal political ends. The thing Mitt Romney said in that quote was the reason for his vote to convict. And you compare Trump's impeachment acquittal with the case of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in Bridgegate. Now, for our listeners who do not live in shouting distance of Fort Lee, New Jersey, would you remind everyone exactly what Bridgegate was?
Yes. So Bridgegate was when top aides to Governor Chris Christie shut off access lanes to the George Washington Bridge, which is the world's busiest bridge, causing 4 days of traffic on the first day of school, misery, gridlocked ambulances, because the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee had not endorsed Chris Christie for re-election. And Chris Christie was never charged, but three of his top aides were prosecuted. One of them pleaded guilty and cooperated, and the other two were convicted of the politically motivated closure of the bridge to help Christie, who was trying to enhance his own chances. So the backdrop of this is it was 2013. He was planning to run for president in 2016, and he wanted to create a narrative that he had a lot of support among Democrats. So he used all of these carrots and sticks to get New Jersey Democratic mayors to support him. And the two aides who were convicted they appealed their case to the Third Circuit. They lost. They appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court heard the case earlier this year, and the oral argument seemed to be very much going in the way of these two individuals. Now, it's complicated because Chris Christie, who was obviously the person who created this culture, was never charged. But the Supreme Court case could set a precedent for corruption prosecutions in America that is very concerning because they've already said. So there was a Virginia Governor McDonnell a few years ago, mm-hmm. took $175,000 in gifts and payments from somebody who wanted to get some Virginia regulations in favor of his tobacco supplement business. This is undisputed.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor McDonnell did things for this businessman. He held meetings. He tried to get people to do things for him. And the Supreme Court ruled that is not corruption, because he didn't do a specific official act. So the Bridgegate is the next step in that. It's a sort of, if that is not corruption, there was a concern raised, even by Justice Breyer. Well, isn't it a severe penalty? What if a mayor says, go plow the snow in a street that's for my more favored constituents? Are we really saying he should be able to go to jail for years for that? So it seems like they are likely to overturn that. And one of the things I know, even after the McDonald case, I would call people and I would say, is this thing that looks like corruption, corruption? They said, well, it sure looks like corruption. But after McDonald, prosecutors don't want to prosecute. And if this case goes in that direction, even more so, it means that it's going to be the disincentives for bringing these cases, already difficult and complex and costly, are going to become enormous.
And, you know, one of the Trump team's key defenses was that official acts for political purposes happen all the time. Obama held back on missile defense to not have a confrontation with Russia before his election. That got brought up. And you could look at any act of, you know, funding a playground or a road repair or closing a bridge or lanes to a bridge or a million things people will bring up to say you can't take the politics out of politics and call everything corrupt. I'm sure you've thought about this.
That is true. But what is different in this case is that both Chris Christie and Donald Trump have created cultures of dominance where you're with them or against them. And there is no compunction about using the levers of government. This wasn't just about opening the lanes to make it easier for the people from Christie-supporting counties to get into New York City. This was about punishing a Democratic mayor who wasn't on the team. Very similar to what Trump did in Ukraine, where he went to the Ukrainian president and said, do us a favor, though, and made it seem like there was no choice and showed that he was using to use the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the budget, the White House, all of these levers of government to enforce a political aim. That is corruption.
David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
First, thank you very much for your show. I wish that more politicians in Washington would listen more closely to what you guys say. It's very clear-cut, and you cut right through it.
Thank you.
My question was, I just wonder whether or not more focus was placed on the obstruction charge, which seemed to be circumstantial in the investigation of Ukraine, whether or not there would be more success in getting more Republicans on their side.
In other words, less focus on the Ukraine Article 1 and more focus on the obstruction of Congress?
Correct.
I think the answer is no.
The answer, I mean, Romney actually did not vote. He found Trump not guilty on the obstruction charge, which was extraordinary to me.
Oh, yeah, that's worth mentioning. We didn't mention that. Explain that distinction. He voted yes to convict on Article 1, but to acquit on Article 2, obstruction of Congress.
Of the congressional inquiry, which was amazing to me because that's directly against his own institutional interest. So, I mean,
institutional in that Congress wants to, traditionally, Congress wants to enhance its power in the balance of power over the executive branch and vice versa.
Correct. And what the framers thought when they were putting in this mechanism of impeachment is that members of Congress would stand up for the institution. They didn't really think about partisan politics because there wasn't really partisan politics when they were writing the Constitution. So the obstruction thing is also deeply disturbing for, you know, and this is one of the other cases that's coming up before the Supreme Court this spring because, so one of the things that many Republicans kept saying is, why didn't the Democrats just subpoena? Last April, the Democrats issued a series of subpoenas to Trump's bankers and to his accountants asking for Trump financial records. And Trump sued, and he lost those cases, and he appealed, and he lost those cases, and now they're going to the Supreme Court, along with the case Trump v. Vance, which is Trump arguing he can't be investigated for anything so long as he's sitting president. And the fact it's going to the Supreme Court suggests, I mean, there's a possibility that the Supreme Court is going to agree with that position, that you can't, no local prosecutor can investigate a sitting president for any reason so long as that president is in office.
And I'm glad you brought that up because Trump v. Vance, Vance is Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney, and Vance is seeking Trump's tax returns. I believe that's the issue in the case, as part of the investigation into the hush money Stormy Daniels case, right?
Right, that's right. So basically, because the Trump Organization put on its books that the hush money payments were a retainer fee for Michael Cohen, that is, could be false filing of business records, which in New York is a felony. So that is one of the things that they have been looking at. And they were investigating. The Trump Organization was actually cooperating until they asked for Trump's tax returns. And that's when he brought this extraordinary lawsuit. And I was in court right here in the Second Circuit in the Thurgood Marshall building when Judge Chin asked Trump's lawyer, wait, what about the Fifth Avenue example? Are you saying that Trump could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not be investigated? And Trump's lawyer said, yes, that is correct. That is correct.
Unbelievable. And so there was Chief Justice Roberts, looking pretty stoic almost that whole time in the Senate as he presided over the impeachment trial. Were you looking for clues about how seeing evidence of Trump's behavior close up might affect his ruling in that case?
Well, I mean, he seems to have receded in the Senate trial. I mean, you know, we're talking about witnesses. I've covered so many trials. I have never covered a trial with no witnesses. And I am sure that he has never heard a case about a trial with no witnesses. There wasn't any sense of sort of weighing in on that. I think that what we know from these series of cases that are coming before the Supreme Court is, so Trump kept losing these cases. He lost the cases about giving his documents or barring his accountants and his bankers from giving their documents to Congress. He lost them in no uncertain terms. The decisions said Trump's arguments are repugnant to our Constitution. One judge said, the president is not the king. These were not gray area cases, and there was unanimity in the circuit courts, and yet the Supreme Court took them. And by that very fact, there is a suggestion, yes, that they are taking seriously the idea that Trump doesn't have to be accountable to Congress officially, which is different from impeachment, right? Because that means officially the Supreme Court is saying Trump doesn't have to be accountable in these ways, and also he can't even be investigated. And this is such a piece with Trump. I mean, he has, as a New York businessman, he acted for years and years and years in this sort of oligarchic way, suggesting that he could not be held accountable for anything that he might have done wrong. And that is something that is now the public and stated position of the president and his attorneys and the U.S. Department of Justice.
Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the WNYC podcast Trump Inc., which follows the intersection between Trump's business interests and the public interest. She has an article in the New York Review of Books called Corruption with No Consequences, From Bridgegate to Impeachment. And she's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. And you know what, everybody? This is it. With the end of the trial, we have reached the end of Impeachment, a daily podcast. This feed hereby expires. I hope we've helped you follow the story interestingly and fairly. But I'm also happy to say that we're coming back to keep following national politics this year with a new show called Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics Podcast. Look for it shortly in this podcast feed, and I hope you'll choose to stay with it. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to Impeachment, a Daily Podcast from WNYC Studios.